have a new interviewer tonight. Her name's Avril P. Yeah, you're listening to Candid Frank Live.
Wow.
There is so much going on right now. I mean, when it comes to the CFL, much more than has been going on for a while. The biggest thing is the combine. As you know, we've been doubling up interviews with prospective players in the draft. Some of the guys that we interviewed have shown well, like Brendan Gallander. He showed up really well at the combine. And I guess the most important thing I can tell you is that there are fresh dreams on the horizon for many a player. There are also different types of situations involving players that are already in the league. And one fella I'd like to talk about plays for the Montreal Alouettes, Jamal Richardson. Now, apparently, he's all fired up, ready to go. He figures he has something to prove. Didn't have the kind of year he wanted to have. Obviously, the Alouettes did not end up where they wanted to be. They did at the end of the season, that's first, but they didn't after the Eastern Finals were concluded. They weren't where they wanted to be, and that is on the winning side of the equation. In fact, they lost at home to the Toronto Argonauts. Now, is that something that Jamal Richardson is going to be able to prove? Well, that's what's going to make the CFL season interesting. Now, you know that he's a great player, and you know that if he speaks, you know he speaks, you know, from where it counts. Now, he's also a new father, and his son's name is Rich. There you go. Also, one of the biggest stories going around right now, a lot of people are surprised that Elliott was released by the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. This week, the GM noted that Buck Pierce is a great competitor, and they still believe in him, and he appears to be, and may very well start the season as the number one quarterback. There are many who are concerned with his injury-prone nature. Now, having said that, there are times when players who appear to be injury-prone have a clean year. It just seems as though injuries follow them around. We mentioned last week that Ron Lancaster Jr. passed away. There's still no information as to how he died. There are some current concerns about how he died. We'll hear about that later, I suppose, when all the forensic evaluations have been done and the families have been notified that have a right to know what's going on first before anybody else. And I suppose that'll become public again. Just sounds like a sad story in the making, doesn't it? You've got Barker of the Argonauts. Jim is not leaving any stone unturned. That's what he's saying publicly. Privately, he has to balance the books, and that's going to be a tough part of his season. There is a salary cap in the CFL. After winning the biggest challenge, some think it's the teams coming in want to beat you, but sometimes you're beaten before you even get that team on the field at the beginning of the year. And that's usually because of the cap and your inability to have enough money to spread around to the existing players that requires you to actually let players go who had an input on the team and maybe even deserve some credit for why they won the cup. And by that I mean the Grey Cup. We also, I don't know, I'm a little surprised that the Lions released Reddick, but Anthony didn't work out. But they did make some signings to compensate for that. The BC Lions are a team that I think they're one of the ones, I think all four teams in the West for that matter, they're all in the weeds waiting to see how Saskatchewan reacts to what they put together. At the end of the day, all these teams will be forced to play against a pretty fired up Saskatchewan team. Now that's another thing that I have in mind that it's a curiosity that I have. How are they going to stay under the salary cap? They've been like a drunken sailor, eh, on the market, going crazy, getting this guy, getting that guy. Man, I mean, there's got to be some money issues with that team. As yet, we haven't heard any. But I got to tell you, don't be surprised if in the beginning of the season there's a fine levied against Saskatchewan, because I can't see them bringing in all these players and not having a money issue, a cap concern, one that they need to take care of. Now, injuries can solve a lot of cap concerns. This is something we're all aware of. Now, you also know the combine's going on, as I mentioned earlier. Who's going to be drafting what? If you want to call and have an opinion on who that should be, you can dial 714-242-5250. That's 714-242-5250. I know it's something to get over, making a call to the U.S. When it comes to talking about a sport that's strictly Canadian. I hope you can get over it and make a call. And that's the number to call, 714-242-5250. We talked about Buck Pierce. Now, I mean, do you think that Buck will be able to have the kind of season where, at the very least, nothing worse than what happened to Ricky Ray to the Argonauts happened? And that would be get injured during the season, come back in time to be in good health to make it to the playoffs or through the playoffs, and then again, of course, all the way to the Grey Cup. Can he do that? That's the minimum he's going to have to do. Now, the season tickets are out there for you to purchase. I'm getting my dates together to figure out which dates I'm going to do what. We're hoping, at least I'm hoping, to be able to do something on home nights with the Argos. I don't have permission from the Argos per se, but we did get their blessing that we wouldn't be getting in their way. So to go to Shoeless Joe's and to hopefully do an after game party and, of course, interviews. Talk to the fans, get their opinion of the game fresh after the game as to what they thought were the best play of the game. We'll talk about the game, of course, and if possible and if available, we'll talk maybe to some of the players in a more relaxed environment. It won't be the kind of thing that you're used to. It'll be different. It'll be basically less pressure, more fun, in the sense that, you know, they can talk about what happened during the game in a positive sense. We're not there to be negative, especially after a game. I can anticipate that there's going to be some difficulty and some interesting questions and interesting answers after the game. Of course, you know, when you lose, you're a little more stressed, right? So that's going to be a challenge for me to get some answers in, and a challenge for you, because you'll be able to call in and ask a question, bearing in mind, this is not, you know, this is not broadcast radio or broadcast television where we're trying to impress anybody. What we're trying to do is to look at it from a fan's perspective and the players talking to the fans, not the fans that are all whiny and boo-hoo-hoo, we lost and it's all your fault kind of fans. They will be filtered out. That's a promise I can make. But the fans will say, you know, that was a, what'd you think of that play? And yeah, I really, the very most, you might say he messed up, but next time I'm going to go after that. And then, of course, that kind of stuff, where we will talk to them about, you know, success and failure during a game. But we won't be talking about it on a personal level, on an individual level, more of a team level. And, of course, the fans get to tell us the biggest thing that I want to happen at these events is for the fans to give us their vote on what the best play of the game was. And the good news is that the CFL on TSN will be going on for a few more years, in fact, through 2018. Those games have been a boon to the CFL. At face value, it may be true that basically the CFL pays to be on television, something people don't want to hear or say, but the fact remains they do it. And the reason they do it is because they need to be on television. It's a lesson learned back in the day. You know, if you're not on television, you don't exist. The Toronto Rock do the same thing. Now, do TSN do a good job in, you know, showing the CFL for what it is, the great game that it is? Do they promote it in a manner that is conducive to it being a growing sport? Again, coming back to as it may have been before when, for example, there were 30, 40, 50,000 people in the stands watching CFL teams. Now, not all the CFL teams are, you know, having trouble. Of course, not all of them are very successful. But what TSN has done, and they have to be congratulated on this score, and the CFL must be happy to have TSN on their side once again, broadcasting their games in the professional manner that they do, the dedicated manner in which they broadcast it as well, bringing in CFLers that care about the game and are the face of the TSN broadcasts. I think that's the best thing that TSN does, and that is, of course, give the people who understand the game, know the game, love the game, the opportunity to be part of showing folks at home and talking about the game for the folks at home. So, yeah, you know, we're going to see Matt Dunnigan again, like him or love him or hate him. Or maybe hate's too strong a word. Having him come back and the rest of the teams of on-air people that are broadcasting the different games in the different cities and also, of course, East and West. Once again, we have another year where the Winnipeg Blue Bombers will be in the East. The question I have, and I haven't heard, I don't know, has anybody else heard? Have you heard if and when the Ottawa whatchamacallits come into the team, win the league in 2014? Will Winnipeg be moving? Have I missed something? Because I'm really not sure. I can't give you a for sure answer on that score. Like, will Winnipeg move to the West? As is, I suppose, many who are out there believe that to be the logical choice and the logical move. I'm not so sure it's logical, only because at this time, and it has been for a few years, that the Eastern Division has been the weaker division. And it may not happen. But again, on the horizon, we have, because of the combine, because of interviewing football players from across the country, because the players that are coming from various parts of the country are really in small pockets in the CFL and in the CFL country, which is Canada. It's not a real connected football combine. You know, there are general or specific areas that provide the best players. Quebec, Sherbrooke, Laval. You've got, you know, McMaster Western, then you have in BC, Alberta and Manitoba are not strongholds for football players. Although if they called me and said, "Yeah, dummy, how dare you say such a thing?" I would say, "Okay, show me." Now that would require a phone call, and that phone call would require dialing these digits: 714-242-5250. For now, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a bit. And here's a little commercial for you to let's do a musical interlude for a change. Yes. And don't worry. You know what I got to do? I got to start pulling some stuff. We got to start getting. I'm back from holidays, and you know when you come back from holidays, you're feeling a little down. I always feel down because I got a problem. I'm mentally ill, so you know I'm on drugs and stuff. So I don't have an issue with putting on anybody from any team. And you know we've been fortunate to have the Argos to be willing to cooperate with us and assist us to the extent that they can, based on fairness to all those around. You know, we've got our little piece of the pie, and for that, I'm grateful. I got to get something going with the Ticats. Anybody out there can help me with the Ticats? I've tried. I've bent over backwards and been. Hey, listen, I've had more luck with Saskatchewan, and that's a team I think. With the help of some of the people that I've met, that I might be able to get some of them in there. But I would really like to get Saskatchewan as part of a weekly thing, a 5-minute thing, just basically, okay, Grey Cup, what's up, what's doing, what's new this week? Let us know. What have you put together? That kind of thing. Montreal may not be difficult. There's obviously an opportunity to really make this thing grow. And now I am ready to jump in. So there is something else that I wanted to talk about when it comes to the CFL. Sitting in the stands. Now, I understand from John Granger that Section 134B is apparently... Our section will be having a few more noisemakers. And from what I understand, it's all been okay for the most part. More importantly, it's been passed by the Rogers Centre, who are the hosts of the CFL games, officially. They're the official hosts. So there could be some noise emanating from that area. Now, there will be a solution to that problem. But more importantly, if you like to make noise, and if your idea of being at a football game is to support your team wholeheartedly in a aggressive but not over-the-top way, then that's a section for you. So, you know, that's my suggestion for you. I was there last year, and it was a lot of fun. It was a year that became a Grey Cup championship for the Toronto Argonauts. So needless to say, the excitement that I shared at that time is, well, I hope after winning the Grey Cup, there's going to be some fans there that are going to really back this team, just as they would any other team, be it in Montreal, Hamilton, Winnipeg, Saskatchewan, Edmonton, Calgary, BC, all those wonderful places where football means a lot to the people who live there. So today I've had the good fortune of hooking up with a guy that I can relate to. And the guy's name is Dan Giancola. Now, I can relate to him for many reasons, but the biggest reason I can relate to him is here's a guy, number 13, born in 1970, was 29 when he broke into the league, played the most or second most games by a kicker in the 2000 to 2010. His rookie season, he kicked 48 field goals, was 28 for 28 in extra points. Dude was a machine. In fact, in 1999, he was a Toronto Argonaut. And he also was a Toronto Argonaut in 2004. And later that year, the Toronto Argonauts won the Grey Cup. We're going to catch up with Dan Giancola and see what he's doing today and talk about the history that he left behind at the CFL. He was there for 8 years, 8 to 10 years, 10 seasons, and also he took a, again, takes a 5-year break comes back at the age of 39 and continues to kick the football. We got to hear what that was like from Dan. We come back after this break. Dan Giancola, number 13, CFL kicker. They're kind of interesting folk, aren't they? That's what I hear. Now, he never was a tie cat, and he never was a rider. So maybe, you know what? What the heck? I mean, let's have a musical interlude, and then I'll get a hold of our buddy Dan Giancola. Hang on, you're up next.
All right, you got it.
Wearing number 13, Dan Giancola. Welcome to the show.
How are you,
Dan?
Hey, that's probably that's the best I've heard in a long time.
There you go. Well, that says a lot for me, doesn't it? I'm pretty
old. Oh, that's good, man. I love it.
Hey, listen, Dan. I followed you on Facebook. We made friends.
Yeah.
I got in trouble because I made friends with you.
Why?
Oh, because Facebook doesn't like people making friends. And then they ask, I said, do you know the guy? I said, no, I'm a CFL fan, and I'm trying to find CFL people to get to know better and to enjoy their company.
Right.
But that's not what Facebook is for. Facebook is for reuniting with old friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's all politics, Dan. You know, the only thing worse than Facebook when it comes to that kind of stuff is being, as a kicker. Now, I played the Green Riders song.
Yeah.
Now, a few years ago, a certain kicker wearing a green shirt missed a field goal.
Right.
And I thought they were going to kill him.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you're a kicker. Let's be honest. You guys are a little – you have the reputation, kickers in general, not you specifically. Kickers in general have the reputation of having one foot not on the ground.
Yeah, well,
that's absolutely. That's part of your talent. But I mean, you seem to do that after you kick the ball, too.
Right.
What is it about kickers? What do you think it is about kickers that have the personality that people basically say they only have?
You know, it's a tough. I can only tell you from obviously from being a kicker, and you know, I mean, I understand the mentality, especially when it comes to, you know, they say kickers aren't players. They're not real players or whatever, and yada yada. You hear that, and they all their own special breed and. You know, but it's really funny, though, and I say this in all due respect to everybody, all the guys who I played throughout my whole career. you know, we would always joke around in practice, especially back in the day when me and Pre Fontaine would go out in the field, and him and I would challenge each other and kick field goals and punt this, that, and, you know, we'd joke around. At the end of practice, we'd always do, like, pressure situation kind of things and having fun with it with the guys. And it was funny, you know, like, they make fun of all, you know, all the kickers all day. They can think of anything. They come up with 1,001 things to make fun of a kicker. But when it push came to shove, when those guys had to kick a ball and, you know, put it on the line, you know, nobody would ever step up, you know. And it really was the funniest thing to see. And, you know, do we beat to our own drum? Yeah, we kind of like to be left alone. It's a mental part of a game. I've never golfed before, so I can't really compare it to golf. I've done a few charity events here and there, and I do understand, you know, about the focus and all that stuff. But, you know, I don't know. You know, we are our own breed. We do beat to our own drum. But like I said, man, when push comes to shove, nobody wants to step up and be the guy on the line to make that kick or not make that kick.
Well, I think that you defined it perfectly. I think that is the difference between a kicker and any other position, for that matter.
It's the most vulnerable position, other than maybe being a quarterback. I mean, a quarterback is allowed to miss passes.
Exactly. He's allowed to make mistakes. It's like the old joke about baseball players. They make $20 million, and what do? They have a success rate of 30%.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
I mean,
that's the thing.
And if a kicker kicks at 30%, we know where he's going to be.
Oh,
with
he's
Dan,
done.
with Dan right now.
It's that simple. He's done.
So, yeah, no. You know, it's so easy. And the pressure, I mean, if that Saskatchewan experience doesn't teach us anything, it should teach us the pressure that's on a kicker. The total pressure that's on a kicker. And that means you can't be an ordinary kind of mentally thinking person. You've got to think outside the box.
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, you know, one of the funniest things we used to always say in, you know, in our meetings and that is, you know, don't worry about whether you missed a kick. People are booing this, that, and everything else, whatever the situation is, because you're in the spotlight. And it's one of those positions where, like I said, you know, as a quarterback, you can incomplete the passes. As a receiver, you can drop them. As a, you know, offensive tackle, defensive tackle, you miss a block here and there. And yeah, but the thing is, as a kicker, you know, if you miss the kick, it takes 1.28 seconds to make a field goal. From the time it leaves the center's butt to the time it hits your foot, it's only 1.28 seconds. And unfortunately, I mean, unless you're in film and you get an opportunity to go over the film and say, oh, okay, you know, the snap was off, the snap was high, the hold was bad, or it wasn't on the tee, or you just missed a kick. The unfortunate part is a miss is a miss. And, you know, and that's what people see. You know, wide left, wide right, fell short. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily always come out. And I think that's, you know, it's one of the hardest things. And, you know, maybe part of the mental game that it really does come down in the kicker is, you know, everything does have to be perfect. It is an art form, and that's exactly what it is. Like I said, to accomplish something in 1.28 seconds at the highest level, yes, it's routine, but if that routine is thrown off even by a fraction of a second, you got yourself a missed kick, a blocked kick, or your kicker's destroyed.
it's one of those three.
you're
100% right. You know, placement is very important, but placement – for you to kick it right, you need the right placement within a certain guideline, right?
Absolutely.
And, but not only that, the center has to deliver the ball in a way that it can be placed within that little zone.
Absolutely.
That it needs to be in. So, you know, this is a combination of three guys. And we're not even talking yet about the guys blocking the kick, you know, the guys trying to block the kick and basically whose job it is to distract you. And I don't know about anybody else, but if I have about 1.5 tons of beef coming after me, I'm a little wobbly in the legs. I don't know how you guys do it.
Well, and that's where trust, you know, trust comes into that. You know what I mean? Is when you, you know, I came from high school football. I played about 9 years minor league football in the States. I mean, I think that's where I really grew a spine and where I learned how to play, for the simple fact that when snaps came back to me in minor league football, they were rolling back, they were going over the top of our heads. I mean, the mind frame was, oh, my God. I mean, if I can handle this league and make 55-yard field goals, can you imagine what it's like to have a perfect snap, perfect hold? So for me, when I got to the pros, it was almost like, you know, a ray of light went through the clouds. And I'll be honest with you, it never came into my mind whether it was going to get blocked or not, because when I saw that ball come back there, it always looked like such an art. I thought in my mind, oh, this is easy. You know, and I mean it in all due respect and being humble. Because like I said, if you would have saw on film what I had to show the coaches over the 9 years of field goal attempts. I mean, I'm sure at some point they're like, wow, I mean, if this kid can get off a kick with a ball rolling to him, you know, or the snap is over the shoulder of your holder and he still got it down and you still made a 50-yard field goal, things became really simple to me in the pros because it was like everything was perfect. So my mentality was a lot different, you know, and I came in a lot more mature too. And I came in, you know, almost the age of 30, you know, where most guys are retiring. I was just coming in. So there's a big difference there for me, between me and a lot of the, you know, the guys coming into college.
Absolutely. So now you alluded to the fact that you played in the U.S. Did you play your whole minor football league career in the U.S.? You are a non-import.
I'm a dual citizen. I was born in Canada, but I'm a dual citizen of both Canada and U.S. My mom's American. She was born on the U.S. side, so I have my citizenship. I started, actually, believe it or not, it was 1993. I went to Toronto in my first year with a semi-pro team, the Toronto Athletics. And Hank Elissick, we played over at Lamport Stadium, and Hank Elissick that year was the owner, and I had a chance to meet him, and amongst, you know, a few other owners that were in with the team. And the unfortunate part was I was driving back and forth from Thorold, Niagara Falls, Ontario, to Toronto every day for 3 months. And it really was I fell in love with it. It was semi-pros. I mean, it's kind of a glorified name, but semi-pro, and we had our own shirts, and, you know, we practiced at Lamport Stadium. Like, I would work a 10-hour day working for the city of Thorold as a student in the parks. And then I would get in the car and drive, you know, 2 hours to Toronto, because I was always driving into the rush hour traffic, and then 2 hours home. I did that for 3 months, and I got my first, you know, kind of, I guess you could say, business or politics. 2 days before it was time to play, the coach said to me, oh, I coached this kid at York University. He's my guy. You know, after I was there for 3 months. So I sat on a bench for about 5 games, and then finally, you know, my wife, girlfriend at the time, was with me, and she said, Dan, you know, maybe there's another place you can go play. So my uncle, who was another big fan of mine, he called up a team in Buffalo, the Buffalo Gladiators. And I played there. I went to 131 free agent camps over 10 years in the pros when I was chasing my dream. And I played 10 years in the minor leagues. And my wife would be the one to take all the resumes. Like, she would write all my kicks. And my uncle would be the one to film all my kicks. And every year we would put together a videotape. And we would send it out to teams. Every year, we send the team a resume tape. And then that's when I would follow up and travel all over the U.S., all over Canada, and I would go to all the free agent camps. And, you know, lucky for me, 131 camps and 9 years, almost 10, of chasing a dream. Finally, Nick Volpe, you know, contacted me and said, hey, man, we've seen you for 10 years. We're looking for a kicker. We know you've never played. You know, and the reason why I never got picked was because the teams always, you know, the coaches, the scouts used to always say, well, you know, you never played anywhere. You never played in front of more than 30 people. So we can't give you an opportunity. And I think they finally had enough of me. And like I said, thank God, you know, Nick Volpe, he's like a dad to me, always will be. I love that man to death. He was my football dad. And Jim Barker and Eric Tillman gave me my opportunity in my first year. And you know what, man? I was like a rock star on tour. I was so grateful, so humble. I played with Pinball, O'Shea, Paul Mazzotti, Prefontaine. They all took me under their wing, and especially those guys I just mentioned, and especially Prefontaine, who took me under their wing, and they taught me how to be a professional athlete, where I had no idea.
You mentioned a lot of character people in that one sentence.
Oh, absolutely, man. I was surrounded by – I mean, that's how I grew. I mean, my first year, if it wasn't for those guys who took me under their wing, like I said, to this day – you know, I just saw Mike O'Shea probably 2 weeks ago in Niagara Falls. They were playing in a hockey tournament over at the Gales Arena in Niagara Falls, Ontario. And we happened to be having lunch with my wife, my daughter, and my mother-in-law. And here walks in Mike. And, you know, man, I'll tell you something. It was like a bolt of lightning through my spine, because the second I saw him, I just wanted to get back on the field. And you just, I don't know, there's no off switch. I don't have an off switch. I could go back and play right now, and I know I can. I'm in shape for it. I could do it right now. But, you know, that happens, you know, when you see the guys and you see the game. And man, just the love. Like, I have so much love for that game. It's just unbelievable.
Well, we've been doing this show now for about 3 months.
Yeah.
And the common thread that goes through this program and through my interviews is how loyal football players are to the game and the players that they play with, regardless of what side of the ball they play on.
Nah, don't matter. Doesn't matter. It's all about, you know what, it's about the friends that you make. It's the people that you meet, the guys you play with. You know, you spend more time with the guys that you play with than you do your own family. And that's the truth. I mean, any player will tell you. I don't care whether you're a kicker or you're on a practice roster. I don't care where you are. You're spending 12, 14, 15 hours a day with the guys, you know, at football, where you eat, you sleep, you drink, you're on the road. I mean, you know, you're with the guys 24/7. And when you're not playing anymore, you know, I can only speak for me. I never played for money. And it's very well documented. From the day I signed in that league, I never played for money. I played because I loved to play, and I would have played that game for free. People want to believe me, they believe me. If they don't, they don't. But I've stated that from day one, that I would still play this game for free because I love it so much. What you miss as a player is you miss the camaraderie in the room with the guys. I miss that, and I also miss playing in front of thousands of people and meeting fans and meeting people and meeting the media and having fun with, man, that's what you miss. I could care less about the money. I do just fine just now as a personal trainer. I told you, I suit up again in a minute.
I'm sure, though, there's a couple of guys that you've played with for 12, 13 hours a day and got to know more than your family that you wished you weren't around and maybe might have tempted you to want more money to play the game.
No. I'm telling you, it's the God honest truth. I think because the guys had the respect for me and they knew it. I really do. I think the guys actually had the respect for me. And when I remember going to the Buffalo Bills in 2000 after I played my year in 99.
Yep.
And I remember Flutie came up to me and he said, listen, he says, you know, if you got 5 minutes, you know, I want to just spend 5 minutes. I want to talk to you. And I said, sure, man. Oh, my God. You know, Doug Flutie, holy cow. You know, and then he came over to me, Marcellus Wiley, who played for the team back then, and Jonathan Litton. They all pulled me aside and they said, hey, dude, you know, listen, we had a chance to read you in the paper and we saw you on ESPN and everything. And he said, wow, man, like your story, like, oh, my God. He says, you know, and the fact that you're walking around and like you're saying you play the game for free. You know, we give you a lot of props, man. You know, like, way to go. Like, you are truly what they call a throwback. Like, these are those guys. And, you know, it's hard to earn those guys' respect, especially to be a kicker. But, you know, coming from the CFL and, you know, going against a guy like Steve Christie, who I've always been, you know, enamored by, and, you know, like, you would think that, you know, you wouldn't be welcome. And I'll tell you, man, it was the exact opposite. And the guys respect you from where you come from, and, you know, you're honest. And, you know, I'm sure there are guys that hate you because you're kind of saying you would play for nothing. Meanwhile, somebody's holding out for $20 million a year. I'm sure I'm not helping his cause out very much.
Well, Dan, let's let the fans at home understand who are some of these names you're throwing out. Christie is one of the greatest kickers that has ever been produced by Canada.
Oh, and, absolutely.
And he played for Buffalo for a very long time, played in the NFL for most of his career, and did come here. I believe he played for the Argos for a short
time.
Yeah,
he came here for a very brief stint. I think he had like 2 or 3 games under his belt or something like that.
Something like
that. I
think.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he played more than that. I thought it was a short period.
I think maybe the better part of a season.
Was it?
I
could be wrong.
No, I could be wrong too. But the point is, we're talking about great Canadian kickers, and Canadian kickers were the first to really, Christie and his type, were the first to really break into the NFL. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Tell us about some of the other great kickers that you admired, many of which made it to the NFL.
You know, man, I wouldn't so much say, like, Canadian. I mean, just in general. Steve Christie was one of my favorites. And, you know, Mike, I'll be honest with you, Mike Vanderjagt was up there too. And the unfortunate part for me, and I can only speak for me, and I don't mean it in a disrespect. Hopefully anybody who knows me out there knows I'm not speaking in a disrespectful way. But, you know, as a kicker, you kind of know your role. You know what I mean? The guys go to war. The guys, you know, and it's really true, they go to war. If you want to go on to that, just go down the field level. You'll know exactly what I mean. I mean, it's crazy. And, you know, at times you got to kind of know your role, and you got to be able to know, like, how can I contribute to the team, but do it in a way that's constructive. For me, what was amazing was when I went to city, I always remember people referring to me as the emotional leader of the team, and I thought, holy crap, are you kidding me? Like, I'm a kicker. You know, you're calling me, like, the emotional leader of the team, but that's what I was. I never directed it toward anybody. I just got sparked up. I mean, that's the way I was. I'm a go-getter. I'm like, you know, yeah, man, get jacked about this field goal I just made. And where I kind of lost a little bit of respect was, you know, for guys like, you know, kind of like Mike, you know, Vaynerjack, where, you know, keep your mouth shut and play the game. You know what I mean? And kick. If people know you're good, you don't need to walk around. And, you know, my dad always taught me that. You know, you let your talent speak for yourself. You don't, or other players or other people speak for you. You don't need to do it, because they admire you and they admire what you do and they respect you. And, you know, so, you know, for me, guys like, you know, Adam Vinatieri, a lot of respect for, you know, a great kicker. You never heard him, I mean, a clutch guy. He's won, what, two Super Bowls? Plus everything he did. Steve Christie, clutch, absolutely clutch. I mean, those are the guys for me that I really admired, you know. But I don't know, I was a little bit different too. I didn't so much admire the kickers, where I more admired, the people, like Michael Pinball Clemens. I loved him as a person. I loved the way he was. You know, I always said, you know, to my parents and to my wife, and even before I got there, you know, I said, you know, that's a guy, if ever I play professional sports, that's a guy I want to be. That's my role model. So I never really necessarily role modeled myself from a kicker. I gravitated myself more toward guys that had the respect on and off the field. Wayne Gretzky, it has nothing to do with football, but that was one of my guys. Like Sidney Crosby, that's another one of my guys. Like even to this day, like I'm not playing, and those are the guys that I would drive to. Even though it doesn't pertain to my sport, I love their personality, what the sport is.
So it's more than a game, it's a lifestyle.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now,
it's some guys will say different.
What's the lifestyle like playing in minor football? You referred to Buffalo, and you referred to the Toronto Athletics. And,
yes.
Help us understand the world of making it. Like, we all know, well, many of us know about the CFL. You make it to the
right.
CFL. Walk us through what it took for you to get to the CFL, and be a little more descriptive. Let's talk about the Toronto Athletics. They were owned by the Athletics. They were owned by Illicic, and they played at Lamport Stadium. For those of you that don't know about Lamport Stadium, it was an AstroTurf stadium. So, you know, but the AstroTurf wasn't the friendliest kind of material.
No. You were spoiled. That was a team that you were spoiled. Like, you really were. Like, the owners did an incredible job in Toronto. I mean, you had practice jerseys. Lamport Stadium was the field you practiced on. I mean, you know, when I was in Buffalo, I mean, you legitimately were in the hood. You were in the hood. I mean, you at times, you know, you were like, whoa.
Well, we're
practicing here.
I assume you practiced during the day only.
We practiced at night. And you know, you practiced.
Night must have been an adventure.
It was an adventure. I mean it. Like, I'm not trying. I'm in a process right now. Literally, I've had many, 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 many people ask me to write a book, and I've always wanted to write a book. And I don't know how much time I have with you right now. So to give you descriptively everything that went on, oh my God! I mean, we could do a whole show. But
well, listen, Dan,
We can go.
I'm going to answer your question. All right, I'm going to interrupt you and slow you down so that you have more time. But also know that we have lots of time, because there's another hour and 15 minutes left in the show.
Okay, I don't want to be selfish.
So don't worry too badly.
Okay.
I mean, as soon as we're done, I might do a little stuff afterwards, and then I'll cut off. We don't have a fixed time here. So whatever time you have to give, and whatever time we feel that is beneficial for the listeners that are listening in. We've
Absolutely.
Already passed the 20 minutes, so the people who fall asleep after 20 minutes have done that already.
Okay.
So what we're working for and towards are the football fans who want to understand better what it takes to become a CFL player and a guy who had a serious tryout with the NFL's Buffalo Bills. So you're not a guy who played, you know, neighborhood football and had a cup of coffee.
Right.
But it took a lot for you to get, like, the 29 age, was it because you didn't have an opportunity, or like you said, because you didn't play for many teams that mattered or many games that mattered, you weren't given the same kind of consideration? Why 29? Why did it take that long?
You know, I started in I played high school football in St. Catharines. I'll backtrack real. I'll make that part really quick.
Give a shout out to the school. Give a shout out to the school.
Dennis Morris High School in St. Catharines. I was on a football. One of my best friends asked me to go on the field, and he said, "Listen, you know what? I was a soccer player my entire life, and one of the things I was known for was a big kick." My buddy asked me. He said to me, "Dan, you know, if you get an opportunity, really would love you to come out for our team. We don't have a good kicker, and we're looking for somebody. Man, all you got to do is kick a football." Well, at the time, I was trying out for the Canadian national soccer team. So I kind of knew my dad would never let me do it. I just knew, you know, that's just the way it was. I mean, you got an opportunity to represent your country. That's a pretty good thing, you know. And so, long story short, I went on the field, and I was handed an orange tee and a black tee. And I remember looking at my buddy, and I said, "Bill," I says, "what the hell is this for?" He said to me, "Well, I think one of them is to start the game, and the other one is like you kick a field goal." And I says, "Well, what's a field goal?" And he says, "Well, you just got to kick it between those posts." So we went about 40 yards back. There was no rhyme or reason. We just went 40 yards back, and he grabbed the black tee. Thank God we happen to have the right tee. And he pinned it down, and he says, "Okay, well, just kick it." And I remember hitting it, and what I did was I took out a run at it like I would a soccer ball. And this ball went, it had to go about 55, 60 yards, like just thumped it. But then again, I'm taking a running start at this thing. I remember on the sideline, the senior coach, because we practice a half a field, half junior, half senior. And I remember the coach said to me, he goes, "Hey, Kumba." And I says, "Yeah." He says, "You Italian?" I says, "Yeah." He says, so I started walking over the side of the field. I looked at my buddy, and I said, "Who's that?" He goes, "That's a senior coach." So I said to him, I said, "Well, yeah, well, what do you want me to do, coach?" He says, "Kick another one." So this time he came out in the field and he told me, just take a couple steps back, though. Don't go do all this fancy stuff and just kick another one. I kicked. I think I made it. I think it went about 55 yards, and I made it. Well, long story short, he brought me over to the senior side of the field. I did a whole bunch of kicks with the seniors. Next thing I know, for grade 9 right through grade 13, I was playing senior football. We won all city championships every year, so I was blessed. And during that time, I just learned to just love the game, and I loved every aspect of the team part of the game. I loved offense, I loved defense, I loved special teams, and I learned. Then all of a sudden, it stopped. It stopped. I graduated in 88. I was out in 89. I did one more year to play football, grade 13. We won. It was done. So for 2 or 3 years, I had nothing. I had nowhere to play. I didn't even know they had teams. So I kept going to the soccer park, which is right down, you know, down the end of the street where my house was. And I used to bring my tee, my kickoff tee. And I had one ball. I had a rubber ball that I got from Dennis Morris High School, and I had my orange tee. And I go jump the fence. You weren't allowed to go. This is a beautiful park. I wasn't allowed to go on the grass. And I think the guys just finally had enough of telling me, you know, you don't have to get off. Just do what you got to do. But, you know, don't get hurt jumping the fence. And I would go. I kick a ball. You know, you got to picture it. I'd be out there for about 3-4 hours till my mom finally had enough, you know, screaming, "Come home for supper." And I would kick for 3 or 4 hours. I put the ball 50 yards down. And in my mind, I used to always say, "Oh, game-winning field goal, kicking for the Super Bowl, kicking it for, you know, the CFL, you know, the Grey Cup." And I would kick it, run 50 yards down the field, go pick it up, take it back, kick it again. And I would do that for 3 hours. And I loved it so much that I had no reason to do it. I wasn't going to go play anywhere, but I loved it.
Finally, you really got really attached to kicking.
Just loved it. There's no, I can't explain it to you. I mean, it sounds crazy because I was a national, you know, league soccer player, and I would take the football to the soccer park and I'd kick it over the soccer net, and I would do this for hours. And 2 or 3 years went by, and finally, I went to Niagara College in Welland, and I started taking business administration. And I ran into a teacher there. He happened to notice me, and he looked at me, and he goes, "Hey, you're Dan Giancola." And I said, "Yeah, you got that field goal record, don't you, in the high school football?" And I said, "I'm not sure if I still have it. I know I had it." "Oh, no, you still got it." He says, a 58-yard field goal. I said, well, yes, sir. I says, well, it was with the wind and everything. And, no, it doesn't matter. He says, well, what do you do now? And I says, well, nothing, sir. I says, I just, nothing. He says, well, did you know you can, you know, they have semi-pro teams out there. You can still play. It's for guys after football, college, you know, university, guys who just love to play, never played before. So I had no idea. He says, well, he says, listen, what if I told you I can get you to go out for a team in Toronto? They used to be called the Toronto Raiders, and now they're called the Toronto Athletics. But even more so, I can get you to try out for a CFL team. I looked at him like, okay, really? I don't know what's going on here, but this is pretty cool. Okay, sure. All right, hook me up. So thinking he's kidding, Mr. Volpe was the very first person, very first number he gave me. And I called Mr. Volpe up, and I said, hi, my name is Dan Giancola. And, oh, hey, son, well, we got a free agent camp. We're going to be over on the riverfront. He says, well, there's a rugby field, and we'll be out there, and you got to pay $50 for the workout. You get a T-shirt, and you got to kick the ball. He says, okay. So I went to the park. My wife came with me. No, she did not come with me. The first one, it was just me. I took my Chevette. I had a Chevette. And I got into my Chevette, and I drove down
hatchback
to Toronto.
Hatchback?
Oh, yeah, hatchback. Yes, sir. 1983.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
93.
And let me guess, it was maroon.
Blue. Baby blue. Baby blue. Argo color.
Go ahead.
Baby
I'm
blue.
Trying to distract you. Go ahead.
So
I'm sorry.
I know, that's all good. I drove to Toronto, and I went there. And I was just mesmerized. I remember seeing Hank Elisic. I saw Lance Chomick. They were all there, and they were just kind of there just to kind of watch the guys and do their thing. And I remember just talking to him. He said, well, you know, kid, just have fun with it. And, you know, la, 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 la. There's a lot of great kickers here. And so sure enough, I went out. I went 17 for 17 in field goals. We went as far as 55 yards out. And I remember at the end, I had an opportunity to finally meet everybody. And one guy was an All-American from the States. He played somewhere. Another guy had this big ring on, and he played somewhere. And these guys all – I remember Mr. Volpe saying, so, okay, guys, so who do you guys feel was the best guy today for field goals? And I remember everybody pointed at me. Mr. Volpe pulled me over, and he said, hey, kid, you did great. We're going to call you. We got kickers right now, but I like – you know, where did you play this, that? I mean, he just went on and on and on and on and on. I left that place, and I'm telling you, I thought I was going to training camp with the Argos. I called my mother. I called my girlfriend, now my wife. I said, hey, oh, my God, I just had the most – I went to a payphone and just started calling everybody from Toronto, and I was just shocked. Well, little did I know that I was going to go through 131 free agent camps exactly like that, identical to that, and I drove everywhere. My wife and I, you know, if it wasn't for my wife – forget about it. She was with me for 9 years. We drove the Chevette into the ground. I mean, legitimately drove it into the ground. We had like 400,000 kilometers on it. I was working in the meat department at Camiso's grocery store for 5 years. I was making enough money to put gas in my car to drive me to all these free agent camps. I was paying for my phone bills because back then we didn't have all this emailing and texting and Facebooking and, you know, and send your film over, whatever, you know, put it on YouTube. There was none of that. We grabbed the VHS tape. We made all these copies, so you had to pay for all your tapes. We had hundreds and hundreds of dollars in phone bills. My mom and dad used to just unload on me. You know, like, oh, my God, like, what are you doing? You know, stop, you know, like, well, you know, I got to get the film out. And every year would be the same cycle. I go try out for all the teams. Nothing would come of it, even though I did excellent everywhere I went, and I would get the same thing like Mr. Volpe would say to me, all due respect, you know, where did you play, son? Where have you been? You know, yada, 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 and all that stuff. And the second they found out you don't have high school football, university football, you're done. And I didn't know. I really didn't know. I just thought, you know, sooner or later somebody's got to give me a break. So the age of 20 went, 21. 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27. At the age of 28, I ran into one of the guys who tried out for the Edmonton Eskimos. And he was at one of my, with the Buffalo Gladiators. And he said to me, man, I'm just offering you some advice. I think, you know, you got a great leg. Oh, my God, I watched you in warm-up, and I watched you in the game. And, you know, why have you never, you know, hooked up with a team? And I says, well, I don't know. Nobody wants to take me. He says, well, maybe you need an agent. And I says, well, what can an agent do? He says, I got a guy. I'd like you to meet him. So his name is Maurice Martin. He's from Mississauga. And I apparently he had two or three CFL guys. He was just breaking into it. And she says, send me some film. So I sent him some film. Next thing I know, I got a call from Dan Rambo of the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. And this is what people don't know. And this is like, again, I'm really giving, my God, all my book right now, I'm telling you all everything right now. But Dan Rambo made the phone call to my agent after he saw everything. He says, yeah, I know about this kid. Every year he sends me stuff. And he says, you know, if his numbers are true, you know what? It might be worth it because Paul McCallum is going to the World League. So they sent another couple tapes to him. They said, you know what? Here's what we're going to do. We're not even going to bother bringing him in for a workout. We're going to sign him and bring him to training camp. Well, sure enough, all of a sudden, next thing you know, it was crazy. All the local newspapers, I'll never forget the St. Catharines Standard. It was the first paper to come out, and it says, Have Leg, Will Travel. That was the title. And you can look it up. If you go, you Google me, you'll see. It's right at the beginning. Have Leg, Will Travel. Danger Gola speaking green. Huh? What's that?
And you did.
Oh, I did. Oh, well, yeah, I
traveled. You did have a leg and you did travel.
I was just, everything went fantastic. The buildup was there. Kojiko, the TV cable over here, they did a big cable thing. The papers were all put in, oh, my God, you know, long shot, this, that, and everything else. And then all of a sudden, my wife and I are in Toronto, the Pearson Airport, and we're just about to get ready for me to go. Me, just me. Mm-hmm. We were, my wife and I were dating. We dated 9 years, 1990 right through to 99. And I'll never forget, they called me and they asked me to get off the plane. And I was like, oh, my God, is something wrong? And they're like, you know, like I thought maybe something was wrong with the luggage, something happened. No, he said, your ticket's been revoked from the Saskatchewan Rough Riders and they no longer need your service. This is what was left of me. You want to talk about crushed. I was absolutely devastated. My family was waiting on it. I can't tell you the amount of people that were all over this. And in 1 second, it was taken away. And I just remember, I looked at my wife because I said, you know, here we are. We've dated for 8 years. And I remember being home having this conversation where we were still dating. And I said to her, I said, honey, you know, I came this far. Mind you, this is after a week now, a week of being absolutely crushed. I said, I came that far. Give me one more year. And if after this year it doesn't work, I think I'm going to get out of the meat department and I'm going to actually go because Frank Camiso, who owned Camiso's, is a good friend of ours. And I said to him, you know, I really like to be a store manager because, you know, I really didn't know very much more. I only wanted to play football. So my wife said to me, she says, well, you know what? Okay, as long as we can kind of get on with our life. And I said, okay. Well, again, I'm trying so hard to make this really condense this. This is the gist, what you, and I'm telling you right now, in the 9 years of going through and you asked me why I took so long, I'm kind of giving you a really short form of what happened. And what ended up happening was I went for one more year. I got a phone call. My agent said to me, he says, listen, you know the league, you know, the Arena Football League? And I said, yes, sir. He says, you know, have you heard of Kurt Warner? And I said, oh, yeah, yeah, he's the grocery clerk. Now he's playing in the arena ball, and apparently he's got some contract or something. He says, yeah. He says, well, the Iowa Barnstormers, John Gregory was one of the great coaches in the CFL, and he's coaching the Iowa Barnstormers. And he says, I have a connection with him. He says, they're practicing at Cocoa Beach, Florida. So I said, okay, well, I'm gone. So, again, this is why we had no money. You know, we got on a plane. My wife came with me. You know, we took my brother along for just a trip, you know, to get my brother out too. And we went to Cocoa Beach. This is what people don't know. So I went out there. And again, I'm making a long story short. I went to try out for the team. And within, I guess, about 5 minutes, what Coach Gregory said to me, he says, he legitimately was going to shut me down after 5 minutes. And he was going to say, we're signing you. You're coming to training camp. Well, one of the coaches said to me, I want you to just do a couple more kickoffs for us. We need a couple more kickoffs. My next kickoff, I tore my groin, my hip flexor, and my quad all in one shot. Everything went. I've never been shot before, but I think I would have preferred a bullet. The pain that I went through in that one moment was just brutal. And I thought, well, I'm done. This was my last opportunity. I'm done. So I remember going back to the hotel, and I have ice pack around my leg, and I'm just a miserable SOB. And my wife said, you know, the phone is flashing. And I remember picking up the phone and says, you got 15 new messages. And I'm like, what the hell's going on here? I picked up the phone and my mom called me. And my mom said to me, where are you? Where have you been? Your agent's been trying to call you. So I said, I just came from practice. She said, well, you got to call him right now. Don't sign with anybody. Doesn't matter how good you did. Don't sign with anybody. So I called him. And all he said to me was, Dan, what are you doing? You didn't sign with anybody, right? I said, well, no, this team wants to sign me, and, you know, this is what happened. And he's like, okay, well, you got 3 months to get your stuff right. You're bleeding blue. I said, bleeding blue? What does that mean? He goes, the Toronto Argonauts are going to sign you. When they found out that you went out there to try out for the Iowa Barnstormers, they said, this kid really wants it. So I had 3 months to piece my leg back together again. Literally piece it back together again. I went to training camp with a torn groin, and a torn hip flexor. And by really, truly the grace of God, somehow they glued me back together again. And that training camp I would never want to go through again, because I'll tell you, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, another hour and a half earlier than the rest of the team, because it took me close to 30 minutes to pull my leg out of bed because I couldn't feel it and I couldn't move. And I figured if I don't get up now, there's no way in hell I'm practicing today. And, you know, I remember the article in the paper. It said, you know, bringing back Prefontaine, he's got the most powerful leg in the league that they've seen in a long time and since Hank Olesik. And then they bring him back David Miller Johnson, who was the first round, first pick, and went on about him. And he said, oh, yeah, we're bringing in there, and they're bringing in an Agra native high school guy. And I remember looking at my agent, and I said to him, you know, man, I guess that's all I'm going to be known at. And I'll never forget this. He said to me, Dan, the longer you're in camp, the more people are going to want to know who you are. And it's exactly what happened. I somehow fought through the first 3, 4, 5 days. They cut David Miller Johnson. They brought in Doug Blevins, the kicking coach of the Miami Dolphins, to help the kickers out. Of course, he brought one of his kickers in, so I had another competition. Thank God I beat him out. And then it was me and Prefontaine. And I'll never forget, it's the only ball in my whole career that I kept is sitting on my table upstairs. I made a 45-yard field goal from the left hash, and it was my only kick that I got during that game. And I remember looking at Jimmy Kemp, and he says, you okay? And I says, yeah. He says, just put your head down and follow through, and everything's going to be great, buddy. Just do like you did in practice. And I remember this ball. You know, you ever hear that expression, like life, you know, it goes so slow at some point in your life, time seems to just stand still? When I kicked that ball, it's like that ball wasn't moving. And then all of a sudden, I remember getting kind of just sort of knocked down on my side. I got hit a little bit. And I remember I heard the crowd, and I just remember looking at Jimmy, and Jimmy goes, you made it. And I looked at him, and I go, and this is the most moving. Everybody asked me, what was the biggest field? I actually got two of them, but this is the one that meant the most to me. I remember looking at Jimmy going, I did it. I did it. Not that I made the field goal. But all those years and all those tears and all that traveling and all the sacrifice, putting off the engagement to my wife, you know, all my 20s, which everybody said that I, you know, peed out the tube there, you know, and you know, and they were gone. You'll never get them back. That one moment was all for me. And I remember running in the end zone and grabbing the football, and as I'm running back to the sideline, not realizing I had to kick off, I'm fumbling the ball. It's going in between the cheerleaders. I'm chasing it around. He's like, oh, my God, I can't lose this ball. I finally picked it up, and I remember Danny Webb, the equipment guy, looked at me, and he says, gee, what are you doing, man? You got to kick off. Next thing you know, Prefontaine ran out there because he saw I wasn't going. Well, Prefontaine went out there, and he played the second half, and he made both of his field goals. And the next game, they cut me. After that game, they cut me. Prefontaine playing the game in Montreal, and he went 2 for 5. And that's when I got a phone call. And it's funny how it worked out, because Saskatchewan called me back, and they found out how well I did in Toronto. They said, well, Paul McCallum is now hurt. We want you to come. The promise I made to Eric Tillman was, if any team called me, for me to call him first and give him the opportunity. And I had to, out of respect. I had to. They gave me a chance.
At the time, Tillman was the GM of the Argonauts.
He was the GM, yeah. I called him on the phone and left him a message, and I said, Eric, I said, this is Dan calling Gincola. I said, I just want to leave you a message. The Saskatchewan Rough Riders called me, and they want me to fly out tomorrow. Well, he called me back. That was a message I left him, and he called me back. Oh, my God, I have you a half hour later. And he said to me, Dan, you know, Pre went 2 for 5. You did really good in training camp. You know, I respect you. Thank you so much for calling me. I'm going to leave it up to you what you want to do. We want you here in Toronto. You were here in Toronto. You're going to do great with us. We want you to do just field goals. That's a deal we're going to make you, just field goals. And I said, oh, let me talk to my wife. Let me call my agent, and I'll call you back. Well, obviously what the decision was. And it was the greatest decision I ever made. Now, I had the year of my life. Where my life changed was Game 3 against the Hamilton Tiger Cats. There was no time left.
We're talking about 1999?
1999, Game 3.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, I'm with you.
That was the one. I had just missed a field goal from 42 yards from the right hash, and Corey Grant returned it for a touchdown, and then like 2 minutes later, Paul Osvaldon hit a 54-yard field goal to tie the game. And I got hit on that play from, I can't remember who hit me. I think it was Rob Hitchcock hit me. And I was getting oxygen because, I mean, he cranked my ribs. I thought I broke every rib on my left side of my body. And I remember Coach Barker looking over to Daryl Adrallin, our coach, special teams coach, and he said, is he okay? Is he going to go in or what? Like, we need him. I remember looking up at him, and Coach Barker will attest to this. He'll tell you because it's something we still joke around to this day. He looked at me and he said, Dan, you're going to win me the game. You're going to kick the game-winning field goal. And I'm telling you, Jimmy Camp orchestrated a drive, man, I'll tell you. He took us all the way down. Miraculously, it was 42 yards from the other hash. And there was no time left on the clock. And I remember Jimmy Clark looking at me, and he said to me, Danny, listen, put your head down, follow through, and let's get the hell out of here. And just to skip back a little bit, just as I was running on the field for that, I remember playing in my mind saying, and I remember saying this, God, this is the way it was supposed to happen. This is how it's supposed to happen. Just before the game and that kick, I remember the media guy came up to me and he said, Dan, you know, we love your story, and not enough people know it yet. And he says, I'll tell you something. When you do something special, like a game-winning field goal or something, your life's going to change forever. Well, he was right. Because when I made that field goal from 42 yards out, my life was never the same again. I was a grocery clerk turned pro. That's what I was known as. Every city I went to, I was blessed enough to grace the pages of the paper. Everybody wanted to meet the grocery clerk. Everybody wanted to know the story of the underdog. And I would stay after hours in the parking lots talking to fans, Calgary and in Vancouver and Saskatchewan and Winnipeg, especially Saskatchewan and Winnipeg, because those are the places where, like, I mean, that's all they got. I mean, football's huge. And when you go out there, I mean, whether you're a Rider or a Bomber, I mean, they love you. They really do. They love you. They hate you because you're the opposite team, but they love you. And I met so many beautiful people all those years. And, you know, the funny, and not to get off topic, I'm really fast-forwarding it now, is, you know, I had the opportunity to play. I was in B.C. You know, when I left Buffalo, I signed in B.C., and Toronto traded me. It was the J.I. Albright, and, you know, God rest his soul. And
Albright,
Heward.
Yep.
Yeah, that was a nightmare, because the whole time that they had felt I stabbed them in the back when I left the CFL for the NFL, and what I tried to say was, listen, I mean, it's not a normal, regular situation. Understand, I can't even believe I'm here right now. And I didn't want to leave. People thought I wanted to leave. My wife and I just had this conversation 2 days ago, maybe even yesterday.
Is that 2000?
You know, I never wanted to leave.
What year was that, 2008?
2000.
2000?
Yes, right after the 99 season, I was courted by 7 NFL teams. And Buffalo was the team that said, you know what? We want you. We want you. We're no workout, no nothing. Come down, sign in bonus, done, leave. We want you. So I said to my agent, please look into this for me, because you know what? Like, we could have went to Dallas. We could have went to Baltimore. We could have went to Cincinnati. We could have went to Chicago.
And
like, we had a lot
Buffalo?
Of teams.
And you chose Buffalo?
The reason for Buffalo was, it was because there was no workout. They scouted me all year.
Dan, all set.
Yeah, I know.
For a very long time. But when you said to me you could have gone to Buffalo or could have gone to Dallas and you went to Buffalo?
I didn't know. I didn't know. My agent never told me. All he said was, we have a done deal right now. And the thing I know, I'm watching it on TSN.
Not that I don't like Buffalo. It's
yeah,
that it
I know.
Go to some of those other teams that are more of the,
well,
they're more NFL than Buffalo, because Buffalo's a different kettle of fish.
Well, the other thing is, too, Buffalo had Steve Christie. The year before that, what ended up happening was, like, the year I played in Toronto in 99, there was the Music City Miracle. So everybody wanted Steve Christie out. And so what my agent was led to believe was, we're going to sign Dan just for kickoffs, and then we're going to work him into the kicking field goal role. Well, I didn't know. I had no idea, because I was told I was going there to compete for field goals, because that's all I did in Toronto for my first year. So, and Buffalo signed me for kickoffs. So
I get
to training camp.
You didn't feel that was your strength, though.
No. I mean, I had a powerful leg, but it's
a different thing, right?
Completely.
It's like people who don't understand that a kickoff is totally different than a field goal. It's more of a placement.
Completely. Like the aiming and all that stuff, that's all part of, you know, what you do. I mean, you're an accurate, you're a sniper. You know what I mean? Like, you put it where they want it. But your approach is completely different. Some guys like a shorter approach. Some guys like a longer approach. Some guys will stand 2-3 steps from the ball because they have such a powerful leg and they make better impact. But the problem was I was under the impression that when I signed in Buffalo, the objective was I was going to sign and I was going to compete for the field goal job. And then if they had to sign somebody for a kickoff, then great, they'll sign a kickoff specialist. So when I went out there, it was the opposite. I hit like 93% of my field goals, but the unfortunate part was my kickoffs weren't going down to the end zone. I was hitting the 5, the 6, the 7, and Christie was just pounding them through the end zone. So, I mean, that was my calling card right there. I mean, you know, I was like, you know, sorry, you know, like, he's doing his job. We don't need you anymore. So I went to Toronto. Toronto traded, J.I. decided he was going to hold on to me as long as he could. And he held me on for the 2 weeks that, you know, they can hang on to you for. And finally, in the last few days, he traded me to B.C. Consequently, won the Grey Cup that year. I mean, unfortunately, I got put into a position where it was either sign a 5-year extension with us or go home. And they decided to do that just before the Grey Cup. So I was a pretty lucky guy. I had a chance to play with Louis Bisaglia. And I remember sitting down in the office, or sitting down in the changeup with Louis, and it was just me and Louis. And I said, Lou, look, here's my contract. Look at it. And Louis looked at it, and he said, Dan, you know, like, it's a good contract, but nobody signs 5-year contracts in this league. You got your wife at home. She's pregnant. You know, she couldn't come with me. So I hadn't seen her for like 3, 4, 5, 6 months. And I didn't want to make a decision just that rash right there in a 5-year contract. And, you know, listening to a guy who's played 25 years in the league and he's telling you this is not the greatest contract in the world that you want to sign, I told him. I said, okay, so give me, you know, what do I do? So Adam Rita said to me, he says, Danny, it's going to be really simple. When I come back, it's either the plane ticket's going to be gone or the contract's going to be signed. I called my wife and I said, honey, pick me up at the Pearson Airport. I'm coming home. And she's like, what are you talking about? I said, well, I told her what happened. So, again, long story short, they won the Grey Cup, and unfortunately, you know, I wasn't on the practice roster, and even then you're not entitled to a ring. It's up to whether the owners want to give you a ring when you're on the practice roster. If you're on injured reserve, you get one. So, unfortunately, I missed out on a ring. 2001, I signed back in Toronto. 2002... I signed, they took me in a dispersal draft to the Ottawa Renegades, which was an honor. Like, I was the second Canadian pick overall, which was just like, oh, my God. It was just crazy. I couldn't believe that. 2003, I went to Montreal with the Montreal Alouettes to take place of Terry Baker. The unfortunate part is when they finally found out what was wrong with my leg, it actually wasn't my leg. Through my physical in Montreal, they found out I had a triple hernia. So they flew me home, and within hours, I was under the knife in Toronto at the Schold Ice Clinic. And this is where life gets crazy. You know, this kind of leads into why I, 5 years later, decided to make a comeback. my mother-in-law had preventative cancer surgery, colon cancer surgery. And shortly thereafter, my father-in-law got diagnosed with colon cancer. Shortly after that, my wife got diagnosed with colon cancer. Shortly after that, my dad got diagnosed with Parkinson's. Shortly after that, my mom had a major seizure. This all happened within about a year and a half. So in 2003, when my wife was getting cancer surgery, Toronto Argonauts called me back. My daughter and I, just before that phone call, got into a major car accident. We got T-boned on a rainy day on the door. So I was suffering from a whiplash in my neck. My wife was in with her cancer surgery, and the Argos called me back. And I remember my wife laying in bed, and I said to her, I said, honey, what do you want me to, like, what should I do? She says, listen to me. I'm not going anywhere. Oh, man, I have a hard time with this because this kills me. This is, thank God for her, boy. Whew. She says to me, I'm here. She goes, don't worry about it. Go to football. My mom and dad will take care of Skyler. My daughter was like 2 years old. We had her in 2001. And I remember going to football for 12, 13 hours, drive home, pick up my daughter, go to the hospital, drive back to the house, go back to football, and repeat that cycle for like a month to the end of the season. 2004, I had nowhere to go. Prefontaine was starting to light it up. He was starting to kick all the field goals. My wife, thank God, was they found her. She had her cancer. She had cancer, but thank God she didn't need chemo or radiation. She's okay. She's like 10 years cancer-free.
She beat it.
My father, pardon me?
I said she beat it.
She beat it. Thank God. Yeah, thank God she beat it. My father-in-law just passed away a year ago, March 23rd. We just had the anniversary of his death just this past week. It finally got to him after 10 years. My mother-in-law, thank God, is healthy across the board. My dad's got Parkinson's. You can't do too much about that. 2004, I got called right at the end of the playoffs, right at the beginning of the playoffs, and Prefontaine had a concussion, and the new owners were there, and these guys absolutely loved me, and I loved them. They couldn't tell me enough how much they appreciated me, how much they loved me, how much they wanted me there, and even when Prefontaine came back healthy, they says, you're not going anywhere. We're keeping you here. You're finished in the year with us. We only had two games. That's it. And I was blessed. Really, really blessed. The kid with...
Uh-oh.
Well, I was... No high school experience. No nothing. And here I am. I'm at the Grey Cup. And we won. And probably the greatest feeling of all was the captains across the board. I was on a practice roster at the end of the year, so I wasn't entitled to a ring. And I remember Keith Pelley, who was a really good friend of mine. I guess they all got together to design the ring, and the captains went to him and said, you know what? We don't want a ring unless Giancola gets a ring too, because out of all of us, he's going to be the guy that appreciates the ring the most. And when you say to me how you and I started this whole thing, and we talked about the guys in the room and everything, I hope now, like literally, I'm long-winded with this whole thing talking to you, but I really hope now you really get the perspective, at least from me, and how much I love these guys and miss them, because for guys to say, who have played in the league for 12, 13, 15 years, and say that they won't want a ring unless I get one, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? So 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, I embarked on my next career, personal training.
Let's continue with that after a short break, and we'll continue with Dan Giancola, the man that quit for 5 years and came back to the CFL, Toronto Argonaut, and, of course, was a different type of football player, didn't have the college-university experience that was a calling card for all the teams, did it the hard way. We'll be back right after this.
There's an unwritten code in Hamilton. If you live by it, chances are you've replaced the last beer in a cooler. You don't talk during the national anthem. You believe that great things can come from a little room above a fruit stand. You know Mac is a university, not a computer. Your child's first words were Oski Wee Wee. You know a red hat looks good with black and gold, and understand that double blue only looks good on the police. You believe hot water isn't a necessity for the visitor's dressing room. You've hit every green light on Main Street twice. You believe there's a little general in all of us. You only wear your good hard hat to games. You know King Kong was more than an ape, he was a five-time All-Star. You've parked on somebody's lawn to catch a kickoff. You know that Porter is a quarterback, not a bellhop. You've worn a kilt to a football game. You understand that every once in a while you have to be the center. You believe a football team can outlast 22 prime ministers, two world wars, a Great Depression, and still give birth to a pearl. You've worn a garbage bag as a raincoat. You've never seen a fair catch. You pick a concession line not based on how long the line is, but how hot that cashier looks. You understand that Labor Day is more than an extra day off. And no matter what happens on the field, your season is a success if you beat the Argos.
Nuts.
If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca.
Argo!
We're back with Dan Giancola, and I just wanted to take care of some housekeeping here. We did say that new reporter Avril Fool would be doing some interviews with Anthony Calvillo, Henry Burris, Ricky Ray, and Travis Lule on the success-oriented history that they have in the Canadian Football League. Well, Avril couldn't make it. Have you ever heard of foosball, Dan?
I have.
Well, this was my Avril foosball thing. Avril, there was no interview with Henry Burris, Ricky Ray, Travis Lule, and Anthony Calvillo. That was my, her name is Avril Fool.
Avril Fool.
I'm just wondering whether anybody picked up on it, how quick they picked up. That was my April Fool's joke. No, no, sorry. There is no Calvillo, Burris, Ray, or Lule on the show
Love
today.
It. Love it.
And my shot at you is, listen, you can talk as long as you want. As long as I'm not snoring, and if you don't hear me snoring, I'm writing a book while you talk.
It's all good, man. It's
your
all good.
Book. I'm writing your book while
we talk. Oh, hey, that'd be great. I hope I haven't bored anybody too much.
No, no, no. You probably have, but don't worry about it. I do it all the time. It's nice to have someone else do it.
Ah, that's good. That's good. I'm glad.
I'm kidding you, brother. Listen, it really is an interesting life that you've had. You really did do it the hard way,
yeah.
You know, and you did before you came back that 5 years you were at Commisso's. I have a friend named John Commisso who used to make all the up here North York in Toronto. They had two places up there. They just finally this year leveled the place in between Keel and Lawrence. And Dufferin on Lawrence. I don't know if you know the place I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Original Commisso's was the one down by Castlefield. And by York, right? Which one did you work at?
I was over on Ontario Street. It was the main store in St. Catharines. It was the mother store. Like all the Commisso family was there. Rocky, Frank, they were all the sons. They were all in that store there. So that was kind of like the mothership around the area anyway that kind of pushed from there.
I touched base with one of the Commisso brothers a little while not Commisso brothers, one of the Commisso family. John Commisso, who used to be the guy that made the sandwiches. And I ran into him. We played pool together, part of a high school reunion thing that I was at.
Yeah. No, they're very, very nice family. Rocky and Frank were two, mostly Frank, were the two that I really admired, and they were so great with me, and their wife Marietta, their son Mike. I was really lucky. I mean, along the way, you got to have successful people around you in order to be successful, because, you know, the time that they gave me off, and, you know, go chase your football dream, you're always going to have a job. And I mean, even after playing my 99 season in Toronto, I went back and I still worked at Commisso's, and you know, that's you know, people were just like, wow. I mean,
what, you know, you're an exaggerated example of the CFL financial world that CFL players play in. You know,
yeah.
Most of them don't make enough money, or at least if, like the rest of us, they want things in life, they've got to work outside of the CFL.
Right. Well, I mean, you do. I mean, it's so much better now. I mean, I know, like, the, you know, the kickers now, they're making $100,000 plus now. I mean, last I checked, I think, I can't remember, Damon Duval was up there when he was playing. He was around $195,000 or something like that, kicking the ball. I mean, my first year I played, the league minimum was $28,000. So, I mean, that's what I made my first year. And, you know, it's, again, I mean, I can only speak for
that's
me.
That's back in what, 19? That's back in 1999?
1999. The league minimum was
$28,000. And around then, that's what an office worker was making.
Yep. Yep. I mean, mind you, though, I mean, I brought back my first check. I remember it was $1,200 after taxes, and I remember walking into the office, and I remember Ian Sanderson, who I think is still there, and he'll tell you, because he said he's never laughed so hard. I went in, and I said, Ian, I think you overpaid me. And he goes, what are you talking about? And I says, well, you know, man, my check's $1,200. And he said to me, well, Dan, that's what you get paid. It's prorated over 6 months. I said, I make $1,200. And I said, oh, my God, I won the lottery. Yeah, and that was based on a $28,000, you know, a year, you know, salary over six
months.
Yeah,
well, it's like you said, I mean, multiply it times two. So now it's a $52,000 a year salary if you prorate it over a year.
Well, absolutely. And,
yeah.
You know, when you're working in a grocery store and you're making, if you're lucky, you're making $150 a week. If you're lucky, I mean, oh, my God. You know, you see a $1,200 check and you're like, oh, my God. But it was funny because, you know, I remember Ian said to me, he says, you know, you really don't know what you make. I say, Ian, I can't believe I'm an Argo. I can't believe I'm an Argo. And I think that's where people really got it. They were like, you know, for a guy not to know what he makes, you know, he's not sitting there calculating and saying, oh, man, this is what I'm going to make a week. And I never did. You know, when I made that comeback in 2009 in Winnipeg, it was one of those things. I just looked at my wife and I just said to her, you know, what do you think? I'm working in a club, you know, as a personal trainer. We don't own our own business or anything. I mean, what do you think? She says, well, you know, if you think you can do it, go for it. You know, I'm not going to tell you no. Go for it. That's what I did, man. I started training double time in the gym. I did what I did back in 90s, training to get my legs strong and everything. And sure enough, man, you know, next thing I know, I started making phone calls. It was a little easier because now I can go and I can actually start, you know, emailing people and putting them on Facebook and saying, hey, you looking for somebody? And next thing you know, John Murphy returned my call in Winnipeg. And he said to me, hey, Dan, he says, listen. He says, yeah, buddy, I remember you. He says, so you're still kicking, huh? Send me some film. So send him some film. I went into the dome right near my house over here in Niagara Falls, and I went and pounded. Like, I just left the tape running. I said, screw it. You know, whatever he sees, he sees. The missed field goals. I went 52 of, like, 55 on this tape that I just kept let running. He called me the next day, and he said, man, listen, how about we set a date? Let's get you out here to kick. And you know what's fun? You know what? It was April 17th because my daughter's communion was April 19th. It was 17th because we had to move the date because they wanted me to do it on the day that my daughter had her communion. And they moved it for me. And I went over there, and I'll never forget. I got there. It was horrible. I didn't get picked up. I didn't know where to go. I got maybe 2 hours sleep. Finally, somebody got a hold of me. 2 hours sleep. I wake up in the morning. It's snowing like hell. You know, typical Winnipeg. Called my wife, and I says, just out of coincidence, how is it at home? She goes, well, right now it's about, I don't know, I think it's about 68, 70 degrees. I says, well, honey, I'm looking outside right now, and I can't see 2 feet in front of my face. And I thought maybe they were going to cancel or at least push it back. And I drove up with John, and John said to me, Dan, listen, this is the Canadian Football League, you know. He says, no, man, we got to do this today. I went 52 of 52. I'm not like, they'll tell you. I went 52 of 52 in field goals on that day. And I remember John Murphy with all the coaching staff. I've never negotiated a contract like the way this happened. I made all my field goals. The second I was done, they shut it down. They all got together in the end zone. And in the end zone, John Murphy calls me over and he says, listen, I can't pay you anything more than Alexis Serna is making right now, but we're telling you right now, we're offering you a contract right now. We negotiated it standing in a snowstorm in the end zone. Called my wife on the phone from the change room, and I said, honey, I says, I did it. She goes, what? She goes, you did? I did it. And she says, you've got to be kidding me. I said, honey, pick me up at the airport. I did it. And now fast-forwarding everything, leading up to training camp, 2 weeks before training camp, I'm kicking over in the dome, and the turf came up underneath my foot, and my leg locked, and I pulled my groin 2 weeks before training camp. And I remember making the phone call, and I just told him, I said, guys, you know, if you don't want me to come, I'm at least being a man, and I'm telling you right now, I pulled my groin, and I'm not going to go through, you know, I got there, and then I got hurt there. I'm telling you right now. They said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to fly you in early because we really want you here. So they flew me in early, and we rehabbed it, and the unfortunate part is just when I started hammering 50-yard field goals out there, Alexis Serna proved that, you know, he can play the year, and he did, and he did okay. He did good. I don't know how good, but I know he did good. And, you know, God bless him. We became really good friends. And unfortunately, that was it. And that's when I said, you know what, man? I have got to embark on a different thing in my life. And one of the things that I love doing is I love helping people, and I love people. Hence my new career.
Well, that's perfect timing because we'll take another short break, and then we'll talk about that new career, which for the people that are looking at our broadcast panel, they'll see some of the pictures of you and your family doing what you love to do, and that is get healthy.
Absolutely, man.
Big, important thing to do. We're going to take a short break, about 2 minutes and change. You can take care of some business, and so can our friend Dan. He can take a breath. How you doing?
Oh, doing, buddy.
Are you wide awake?
Oh, I'm good, man. I love this stuff.
Now, you did in fact change careers.
Yeah.
You're into I guess you have a gym.
I got my own personal training studio. It's a gym, gym setting.
Well, tell us about how that all began for you.
You know what, man? My passion, you know, it's one of those things, you know, sometimes you, in life, you just really don't take a, you know, you, I don't know, you just kind of take it for granted. I've always been a gym rat. I've always loved going to the gym and training and being healthy. And, you know, I just feel good, you know. And I think I really drew the respect from the athlete perspective is when I went with the Buffalo Bills. I was 205, roughly around there, my first year playing with the Argos. And my next year when I went to Buffalo, they beefed me up to 225, and I had all the respect of an athlete, but a kicker or a guy who worked out. And so I just became a personal trainer. It was one of the things. I loved the grocery business and all that, but I thought, you know what, man, if I can get into doing some personal training, I think I'd love to do that. Got my certifications and kind of taking the same approach as football. You know, I've been working for the man, you know what I mean? Like the Good Life Fitnesses and the Premier Fitnesses and this fitness and this fitness. And, you know, it's one of those industries where, you know, the club makes out like a bandit. You know, like they take 70%, you get 30%. And, you know, and I did it for 10 years. And I had finally had enough. I said to my wife, and this has only happened 2 months ago. I said, honey, you know, like, we got this thing going on. It's going fantastic. You know, we're just doing it kind of part-time. We have people on the side, like, just to have some fun and do boot camp-style training. But the people were loving it. They were just like, wow, you know, like, let's just keep this going. And I started in a room. It was, like, 500 square feet. It was an old dry cleaner's. And I was in there for about 5 months. And how did the Lord's name that I maintain keeping, you know, people in a 500-square-foot room, nowhere to breathe, you know, training – you know, it blew my mind. And that's when I kind of, you know, the bell kind of rang. And I thought, you know what? This is pretty cool, man. If these people are sticking around for this, I got to really take this thing serious. So my wife and I got into a 1,200-square-foot unit that we're in currently right now. And it's off the wall. It's off the wall. 2 months ago, I had 20 people. Now I'm probably rounding 80. It's just boomed. And it's amazing because, you know, it's, I'm not Dan the football guy anymore. Like, you know, I'll always be the football guy, but before people wanted to train me because I was Dan, you know, the CFL guy, NFL for a little bit. And now, you know, I'm Dan, you know, the trainer. And it's just amazing because we're just getting unbelievable results. We're building such a beautiful family at our place. And, you know, and I just take that passion and that love and I take it in there. And I think that's what people love it about it is, that passion I had in the field that people see, I do. I have it in the studio. And when I got 20 people in front of me and we're training them and they're getting their results and they're losing weight and they're getting a better life, it drives me and I love it. And it's showing right now. And you know, I'm not going to stop. I'm on fire right now. I am literally on fire right now. Beautiful things are happening. We got a clothing line developed. My wife is all over that. She's taking care of all that stuff. I mean, really, technically, I'm still working for the man. I'm working for my wife. My name's on it as the owner, but she does everything. She does everything. I train people, you know, but I am having the time of my life right now. It's keeping me in my element, what I love to do, which is being a personal trainer, but and you know, being an athlete and training. But at the same time, too, I really do. I love helping people, and I'm a people person. I always have been, and, you know, it's just me, and I love it. You know, it's anybody wants to check it out, anybody at all, if it's okay.
Go ahead.
It's www.btoperformance.com, and that BTO means, you know, that I'm patenting a whole name and doing all that stuff right now, and, you know, hopefully maybe, you know, we can keep in touch, and I could talk more about in depth what the name means to me and everything, because I think when you hear the one thing that I've kind of left out of this whole conversation, which I can't say yet because we're working on it right now, but, you know, maybe I could talk to you again about it when it's all done, and I think you'd really appreciate it.
Dan, here's a question for you.
Yeah.
What is the hardest part? Now, you're preaching to the choir here, okay? I'm next year I'm going to be turning a big digit or a big double digit, okay?
Yeah.
I'm getting closer to the triple digits, closer than I want to be. And what's the toughest thing that you deal with people trying to, you know, be healthier?
Discipline, creating a lifestyle. That's, I mean, you know, if I had, I think you could put those two together. I think they pretty much mean the same thing. It's creating a lifestyle. Because when you're so, you know, if you train a pit bull or any dog, I'm not even going to pick a pit bull, but just a dog in general. You know, if you whack a dog in the head with a shovel, you know, every time you see the dog, he comes around the corner, what's eventually going to happen? The thing's going to snap. And that's all it's going to want to do is snap, 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 snap. In order to try to retrain the dog, you can't have that mallet in your hand. You got to be calm and cool around that animal. You have to create a different lifestyle and a different approach for what you do. And that's a little bit of more of, you know, kind of an aggressive approach, what I'm saying. But at the same note, I mean, if you're so accustomed every day, like, you know, pop is your drink and your way of choice, and chocolates and bags of chips and ordering pizza and fast food, and, you know, you're constantly eating that. I mean, only bad things are going to come of it, and we all know it. But you got to learn how to create that lifestyle, and sometimes a lifestyle's got to be created in a slow manner, not something so abrupt, because that's why I can't stand things when they talk about diets. Diets, do they work? Yeah, they work. Of course they work. All kinds of people lose weight on diets. The reason why they're not successful is because it's not something where you're going to dedicate to your whole life. You're looking at it as a quick fix.
Dan, I got a problem. I got a problem with what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what my problem is?
What?
You're putting down pop and your name is Cola, John Cola. No, I mean, I'm just saying. Like, you know,
totally,
like,
I like that.
Like, I think you should back up from that kind of action. Cause your name's,
I like that.
I'm just kidding.
Good.
I'm just kidding.
That's good. I like it.
And my kids, John, don't drink cola. My problem with my children is that we kind of train them not to drink pop. And pop became a treat, you know? And I wish, and I'm grateful because they're, I mean, you know, there's people, and let's be honest, okay, because this is the tough part of what you're saying as far as hitting the dog in the head with a shovel. I know it doesn't make sense to a lot of people, but let's try to understand what Dan is trying to say. And essentially, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Well, absolutely.
Until you help him understand that he's thirsty, right?
Right,
you
got to
help him understand that he's thirsty. So well, once you do that, you're good. You know, we tried as hard as we could to keep our kids away from pop. I know I'm not going to get any Coca-Cola advertising or Pepsi now, but I'm sorry, I don't mind it. It's okay with me. You know, there's a lot of things that society throws on our children that they shouldn't be throwing on them. Now, I'm not going to children and getting people all upset. Oh, there he goes. He's talking about kids. The problem is that's where it starts, you know. And I guess the only thing I do know, and this is the part I do know, and I'm guilty of eating stuff I shouldn't eat, it's much easier to lose weight you shouldn't have had in the first place than it is to watch what you eat and do the proper kind of exercise that's required for you to feel healthy.
Right. Well, absolutely.
You know,
well,
that's a mistake we all make, right? It's harder to eliminate, it's harder to lose weight than it is to not allow your intake to be uncontrolled.
Right. Absolutely. No, 100%. And that's and the other thing is, too, is it's just society. I mean, you know, especially, you know, these days, you know, back in the day, I had my mom at home, and my mom, you know, God bless her, oh, my God. You know, my dad went to work. He put, the roof over the head. The food is on the table. But, you know, every day my mom cooked something. Every day, you know, for dinner. There was leftovers, so you had it for lunch. And we went to McDonald's, man. I'm telling you, it was like you won the pot of gold. Like, you were just, oh, my God, we're going to McDonald's today. Nowadays, is, you know, both parents are working. You know what I mean? They come home.
Yep.
They're exhausted. It's a lot easier to go through a drive-thru and say, oh, you know, I have combo number one, number two, and number four. You know, and you're good.
Dan, if I can interrupt, it's not just the drive-thru. It's a lot easier to take them to a place where there's a jungle gym that they can stay busy for 35, 40 minutes while you finish doing your business.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that just comes with the different lifestyle. But one of the things I have learned through my clients, you know, in their lifestyle, but also my own self. Like, you know, one of the things my wife and I, we said, now, you know, with this business we got going on, you know, like, it's been 2 months, and it's really hard. But now this is what we've done. You know, my wife works, you know, 5 days a week. She has Wednesday afternoons off, and she has weekends off. So what we do is, you know, and a lot of times it takes away from, you know, going out on weekends and that, but she'll cook the meals on a Sunday, and she'll prepare from Sunday right through to Wednesday, and then Wednesday afternoon, she cooks from Wednesday through to Saturday. And then every now and then, once a week, you know, we'll throw in going into, like, you know, the keg or something like that, and, you know, we'll eat out that one night. But it's preparation, and preparation is everything. And if you can get past the laziness of preparing the foods, you'll definitely be successful. You'll definitely be successful. It's what happens is like, I got to get up in the morning at 5 o'clock. Oh, my God, I didn't want to get up at press news. And you know what? I just don't feel like getting it. you know, I'm just going to bring money today. I'm just going to go buy my lunch. And again, it becomes a lifestyle. You're like, oh, yeah, I'll just go to Tim Hortons today. Oh, yeah, I'll just go wherever today. And I always said, and the reason why I can say that is because I'm one of those people. I can be extremely lazy. And I know if I don't prepare my stuff the day before, forget about it. It's not going to happen. And that's where my wife and I now have become really successful now is because, you know, she does all the cooking. She gets it all done. She gets it done. Not everybody has that time, but we've created it. And that's sometimes you got to do that. And now, you know, that's what she does. You know, Sunday she cooks. Wednesday afternoon she cooks. Not a lot of meals, but enough for the dinners. And so far so good. You know, and this is what I try to preach to my clients. And, you know, I just finished a weight loss challenge, an 8-week weight loss challenge with my people. And a real success story right now is one of the girls, and she lost 22 pounds in 8 weeks. The girl has fibromyalgia, arthritis throughout her body. She's going through all kinds of things with her personal stuff with her kids. I mean, you talk about every reason to make an excuse to go out and eat junk or just go on this big binge and do whatever, and she stayed the course. And she lost 22 pounds in 8 weeks.
Wow,
and
that's awesome.
It's incredible. We had those results all the way through the whole 8 weeks in the challenge. And I think that's really why, you know, things are so successful right now. And, you know, when you and I were joking at the beginning, we were talking about Facebook and, you know, we were saying about, I really use it for business. And I use it also to honor my people. I'll put out the videos and I tag people with it and they show their families what they're doing. Next thing you know, I got their families are calling me and we want to come in. And I mean, that's why we've doubled in size.
Well,
and
you know, I would prefer if you referred to it as I would like to refer to it.
What's that?
It is a way of me sharing common interest with others.
Absolutely. There you go. I like
right?
that.
And that's what I do. Look, I don't make any money doing what I'm doing right now. What I enjoy is the CFL. I enjoy meeting former players like yourself. I like meeting the players of today. And as I said to you before, and the guys who are aspiring to become CFL players, that are those guys that went through college and aren't handicapped by the fact that they are only coming out of high school. It is a pleasure to meet these people because the game is not that good to the people that love it. It really shows the kind of love and dedication the people who are in it have for the game.
Absolutely.
You know, that's the thing that people have to understand is that, the CFL isn't very kind to the people that love it. But you know what?
Yeah.
It's bigger than the CFL, and it's not the CFL's fault that, they're making changes. They're doing things. Let's talk a little bit about that from your perspective on the sidelines. Back in 2004 and today, you've got a CFL that is growing back, if you will. They had some tough times.
Right. No, I mean, they have. And, you know, I think one of really, if you want to sum it up to, is one of the models that they have out there right now. And then that was the Montreal Alouettes with the smaller stadiums, the more intimate kind of thing. And I think that's what the teams finally have gotten. Truthfully, are the owners, in the Canadian Football League. I think that's one of the things that became, you know, really well known is when you went to play in Montreal, it was a Molson Stadium there. I'll tell you something, man. There was no more electric place in that place. You couldn't hear the guy beside you. You know, it was all hand signals. I mean, it was just absolutely crazy. And you're seeing it now with the designs of the new building, Hamilton, and, you know, even Winnipeg. You know, they're building stadiums now that are only seating, you know, 20, 25,000 people. And hopefully Toronto will be one of those. I love the Sky Dome. I'm going to call it Sky Dome because that's what it's always going to be to me. I understand whatever they're calling it now. They're calling it, but you know, at one point Sky Dome was the biggest entertainment place in the world. That's what it was called. You know, like everybody went there. It was the big Sky Dome. But the Canadian Football League needs to be in a the venues. You know, they need to be smaller. They need to be like. That's what the seating capacity, you know, needs to be, 20, 25,000 people and always full and, you know, that intimate feeling of being close. And that's what the CFL is being close, where NFL is more hands off. You know what I mean? Like, I can't
tell
you the amount of times.
It's more
it's all about money, you know? Like,
yeah,
they don't want you out signing all your cards because they say you devalue yourself. the CFL, I mean, they throw you right out there. Go nuts. You know, we have fan day. Everybody come on down to the field, you know. And I can't tell you the grief that I got in Buffalo, you know, for staying after and signing, you know, till the last person went home, you know. And not knocking the league. I'm just saying in general, the Canadian Football League in general, I think that's why it's really kind of on the upscale, is because they've gone away from, they lost a lot of the grandfathered people, the ones back in the day, and they had to gear more toward the youth. And I think they've done a really good job of it, with it.
Let's try something else, and I'm going to lean on you a little more than I probably should. But here's the next thing I'd like to talk about. You were the second Canadian drafted for the Ottawa Renegades,
right?
And tell us we'll talk about that experience first. Going to the Ottawa Renegades, being the second Canadian overall pick, and tell us what that felt like again.
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, it was incredible. I remember sitting down I knew that they were doing the dispersal draft, and I was on the computer. And my daughter was on my lap, and my wife was upstairs. And I couldn't find a site where they were updating it, you know, because I knew the draft had already commenced. And the next thing I know, I found one, and I was scrolling really slowly, and I saw number one pick, Kelly Wilshire, and he was with me in Toronto. And I thought, oh, wow, Kelly's gone, man. He's in Ottawa now. And next thing I know, I see kicker Dan Jagola. And I thought, wow, I must be on the wrong site. I think they're just going through our roster. Man. And I scroll down again, and I saw from another team. I'm going, oh, my God. And, oh, man, I had to be 5 minutes after that, I got a phone call from Joe Pow-Pow and Eric Tillman. And they said, we just want to let you know we took you in the dispersal draft and welcome to Ottawa. And, you know, are you okay with it? And, well, yeah, I'm excited, man. Are you kidding me? Yeah, let's go. And, you know, I yelled at my wife upstairs, honey, we've been traded again. And she, no, we haven't. You better come downstairs. We're moving to Ottawa. And, yeah, and that's how that all went. And beautiful, great city. Great city. I had, once again, I had a little bit of an injury problem in Ottawa. And what we thought was my groin, and again, it was just aggravated continuously, which was the hernia. And but for the time I had there, just beautiful city, and I'm glad they got a team back.
What suggestion would you give them, being as close to that as you were? Dan Giancola, not Dan Giancola, CFL player, but you as a fan, what is it that needs to happen to make the CFL work in Ottawa from your small experience there?
Ownership, period. You got to have the right people there. I mean, I don't know too much about the Gliebermans or whatever it was there, but, you know, some of the stuff that was going on there, like they had New Orleans Day and, you know, the beads and, you know, you need the right people to guide it. I think if you would have had somebody like a Keith Pelley over there running it like he did in Toronto, where he brought it back to Toronto, you know, I think, honestly, there would have still be the Ottawa Renegades. The fans loved it. I mean, it was just a great place to be. When I was there, like I said, I wasn't there too long, but when I was there, oh, my God, I mean, you know, the stands were packed. It was like old school. Everybody, I've never been there before, but, you know, they were telling me that it was back in the days with the Ottawa, you know, the Rough Riders, and how one side was called the North Side and the other side was called the South Side, and they would be taunting. It was everything they said it was going to be. And who the heck would have thought, you know, that short 2 years later I would have been winning the Grey Cup in Ottawa, you know, like, amazing. 70,000 people that night. You know, it's just, wow, you know. I think it all came down to ownership, because I know the fans love the game.
Yeah, that's the tough part of you know, unfortunately with every franchise, even in successful leagues, what we're talking about now is the success of a team remaining based on, you know, meeting their needs as far as profit margin is concerned, right?
Right.
And if you don't have the right kind of people that know how to, you know, your mother and my mother would say the same thing. When you work at the Giardino, you have to give the water, the fertilizer, the right amount.
Yeah.
You don't give
especially
it the right amount,
up.
You get enough fruit.
Yeah.
Right? You get enough vegetables, you get enough fruit.
That's it.
And that's all there is to it. And unfortunately, it takes I don't think it's as easy as we'd like to think that, you know, when the league picks an owner to be the owner of a team, they really can make mistakes only because you really don't know until the people get their hands on the controls.
Right.
It appears at this time, anyway, from what I'm seeing, that they have a pretty good ownership there right now, an ownership that understands the Ottawa region, that understands small market mentality, and they don't suffer any pretense that maybe some other owner might have going and moving forward. So
right.
I think they've got a really good chance there, in my opinion. I don't know.
Oh, I do, too. I really do. I feel really – I mean, I personally feel really good about it. And, you know, they got – they're already putting good people in that. I think they got Marcel Desjardins. They're the general manager putting stuff together. I had him when I was in Montreal with Jim Popp. And, you know, it's like you said. It's a trickling down effect. You know, it starts from the top, and it trickles down. If you got things going wrong up top, you're screwed going down because – you only learn from bad habits. And, you know, if you set the precedent and you set it right, good things will happen. And I think that's key, and I think they got that now.
Do you think it's an accident that Desjardins didn't get the GM job in Montreal, instead got the GM job in Ottawa?
Maybe.
You know what I'm getting at, right?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Like Montreal could have had him, and they pronounced, before they got their GM, that they were looking for a guy that spoke both languages.
Well, it is what it is. And it may be that. I really don't know. But does it help the situation out? Absolutely. It always helps the situation. Because, we're saying, you want to be able to relate to the community. And,
absolutely.
You know, he's excellent at what he does. He is, you know, he's French, he's, you know, French-Canadian. I mean, you know what? They're doing all the right things. I think, yeah, I really do. I really do. I think he's a perfect fit for the job. I really do. I think he's fantastic.
Well, he's great. He would have been great for Montreal, but I think Ottawa needed him more. That's the
absolutely.
Point I'm trying to make.
Absolutely.
That's the point. And I can just see Mr. Cohan's hands on the levers on that one.
I know a lot of people
won't agree with me, but I'll tell you right now, the CFL is a brotherhood, and it's
right.
the only way they're going to survive.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if they go after each other, they're just going to kill each other.
There's only so many teams. I mean, you know.
Absolutely. No, but the point I'm trying to make is that they've got to enter this as a mutually beneficial experience for all the teams.
Absolutely.
You know, because
absolutely.
the CFL is a Canadian league in a sport that has a very deep-rooted appreciation, but it isn't deep-rooted enough to survive, you know, stupidity. I'm sorry,
right.
but that's just the way I feel about it.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you. I totally,
okay.
you know, you can't, it's a league that, you know, with as least teams as they have, you know, and looking at wanting to grow in other cities, there's no room for error. And they're heading in the right direction right now. And I really truly believe that they're going to be great.
Well, Mr. Giancola, it was the largest pleasure of my life talking to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're
I'm
welcome.
Honored to have had the opportunity.
Hey, listen, I'm blowing smoke up your ass, but it isn't that much. Okay?
No, really, I love doing stuff like this, and, you know, and I do miss it, and I really am a very, very much appreciative of your time. I really am. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I really enjoyed it.
We'll have to touch base again.
Absolutely. Anytime, man.
Dan Giancola, former Toronto Argonaut, played for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers as well. Ottawa Rough Riders drafted by the Renegades, one of the first two Canadians drafted. For my friends at the Jeepers Creepers, bring Ottawa back to the CF. Allison, I was on Facebook with her, messaging with her, assuring her that what I'm doing is pro-CFL. I've got a kind of a blessing from her. I'm not sure how much of a blessing, but it really doesn't matter. What's important is I am talking about the CFL. I am talking to former CFL players. And most of all, I really enjoy Canadian football and have had an opportunity to get to meet many of the wonderful people that make up Canadian football. Canadian football is in good hands. Good news is TSN's back. I mean, a big corporation like that they could put their support behind that kind of league, being the CFL, is awesome. And thank you to all of you for listening. For those of you that listened, for those of you that didn't call, shame on you. I hope you'll call next time. You've been listening to the Candid Frank Live Show on Blog Talk Radio. I hope to hear from you at some point. Get brave, make the call. But for now, this is the stale dated extra that I made a few months ago.
The following is a message from the 2012 Grey Cup champions, your Toronto Argonauts. If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca.
Argo!
Thank you for joining us tonight for the Candid Frank Live Show, heard on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 10:30 to 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio. Have a great night, everyone.